Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, a long interview with the political economist Mark Blyth about the economic roots of international Trumpism. First, a few comments about Trump et al. The Russia mania continues. It looks to me like a lot of mainstream Democrats are using the Russia obsession as a substitute for a political critique. So the problem with Attorney General Jefferson Beauregard Sessions isn't that he has a closet full of bedsheets at the ready for nighttime cross burnings. It's that he lied about a meeting with a Russian ambassador. And not just any Russian ambassador, but a reputed ace spy recruiter. With FBI Director James Comey already outed as a Putin puppet by no less than Paul Krugman, his exact words on Twitter, "We had an election swung by a faction of our own security sector in alliance with Putin," we now have to view the entire Justice Department as a Kremlin asset. But what will the Dems say if Trump and company somehow got on top of the Russia stuff? Or if a semi-clean slate, free of the Moscow taint, maybe even with Trump himself out of the picture, ended up in charge, but with exactly the same vicious reactionary politics as the present gang? I fear Dems would be speechless. This problem is an extension of Hillary's strategy of treating Trump as somehow uniquely bad, not a real Republican. He's bad, but how I wish he were really unique. And now on to Mark Blyth. Blyth is a professor of political economy at Brown University. He's best known, aside from his fame as a YouTube personality, as the author of Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea, which Oxford University Press published in 2013, which he discussed in Behind the News in May of that year. Here he is to talk about neoliberalism, Trump, Brexit, and all that. Early in the interview, Mark Blyth mentions a Guardian article, actually it was in The Observer, the Guardian's Sunday relative, about Robert Mercer, the Trump-supporting hedge fund billionaire who's spending heavily to remake the political and media landscape. Observer reporter Carol Cadwallader opens her piece by noting that if you type mainstream media is into a Google search bar, the top suggested completions are dead, dying, fake news, fake finished. It's not just her. I got pretty much the same thing with garbage instead of finished. The results are stacked thanks to the work of a network of right-wing operations subsidized by Mercer, which link to each other and thereby boost their Google rankings. Mercer first did high-end work in artificial intelligence and language processing, and then went on to form a hedge fund, Renaissance Technologies, that trades largely on algorithms. He set up the original Breitbart News with a $10 million gift. He's close to Steve Bannon, former wicked genius of Breitbart, now the man who allegedly thinks for Trump. Mercer has a stake in Cambridge Analytica, a data firm that was spun out of a bigger British company, the SCL Group. Cambridge Analytica and SCL have long experience around the world generating election propaganda. Cadwallader, the Observer reporter, rightly calls it PSYOPs. They've worked for the U.S. and British governments as well as for NATO. And Cambridge worked in both the Trump campaign and Brexit. Its raw material are Facebook profiles, which it mines to create psychological profiles, of 220 million people in the U.S. according to the firm's website. The aim is to target recipients with information that's custom designed to grab them by the lapels. Their interventions almost certainly contributed to Trump's Electoral College victory. Sinister stuff. All right, now on to Mark Blyth. I'll have some comments on his invocation of generational war at the end of the show. You know, we keep reading, especially from August organs of the center-left like Vox.com, that the Trump phenomenon, and relatedly the Brexit phenomenon, are not really about economics, they're about bigotry, which has seemed some sort of first cause in itself. Nothing causes bigotry, it's just there forever. I don't really understand their explanation of where that comes from. What do you think of his analysis? It just say it's all racism, it's all xenophobia, and that these economic explanations are attempts to evade the truth of the deep bigotry of a certain portion of the population.
Well, I think that could be true. But then someone has to explain something, which is, did that portion of the population suddenly double in size? Because I've yet to see any real data attached to any of these claims. So we can track real wage gains and losses. We can talk about communities affected by Chinese import competition. But nobody yet has shown me, beyond vague assertions back to 1950s revived psychology about authoritarian personalities, that there's been a massive spike in the number of people who are racist and who showed up to vote. In fact, if you look at the blue wall states, and you look at the five that fell that weren't meant to, and you look at it on a county-by-county level, I believe it is not incorrect to say that the majority of those states voted for Obama, in some cases twice, in which case they became suddenly racist, which, as you say, is a prime mover unmoved. So I have been trying to push back against this, not because I think it's all economics, but because the way that we tend to think about these things is it's all A or it's all B, and if it's B, it can't be A. It's just a singularly unhelpful way of thinking about this. So the race thing, Jonathan Kirshner had a wonderful piece in the LA Review of Books where he said the following, and I think it sums it up nicely. While it's absolutely true that not everyone who voted for Donald Trump is a racist, it is absolutely true that every racist who bothered to vote voted for Donald Trump. Okay, fine, move on. And if you move on from that, where do you go? You have to go to the underlying causes of what seems to be the spike in misogyny, bigotry, hatred, demonizing anti-immigrant sentiment, which is going on across the world. And that, in my read, takes us back to a longer story about economics, which has been 30 years in the making.
After having made fun of Vox, I'll say something nice about it. Matt Iglesias had a piece shortly after the inauguration, I think, in which he said it was really wrong to talk about the Trump voter or Trump voters as a block. He said he thought there are at least three specific kinds. One is the hardcore haters, the neo-Nazis, the xenophobes. The second is normal Republicans who would vote for just about anybody who was nominated by their party, and they just care about tax cuts and deregulation and the usual Republican agenda. And then a third group, which is the floating discontented, who are just, you know, flipping the bird to the established order by voting for Trump. So that seems a little more helpful way to think about his base, at least.
Well, let's take that third category, because that's the most interesting one. And I'm going to riff off something a friend of mine said. His name you probably know is Nassim Taleb. And although he's usually seen as a bit of a sort of a demon figure because he's even close to people in the Trump establishment, I think he's an incredibly smart guy. And this is how he spoke about the election. Now, have you ever eaten a McDonald's?
Yes.
Right. Now, this is his way of thinking about it. I think this is very helpful. So your thing about McDonald's is people eat it because there's no real downside, but there's no real upside either. Now, if you think about elections, people have been coming in from basically the coasts where those elites live, or at least that's how it's seen. And they asset stripped your neighborhood 20 years ago, re-intermediated it in a giant housing bubble, got their assets bailed out, and show up and tell you that everything's fine. Now, they've been eating apparently lobster and cassoulet and all this fancy stuff. And every 4 years, doesn't matter which politician, which party, everybody comes in and says, vote for me, cassoulet, vote for me, lobster. And at the end of the day, you're left eating McDonald's. Now, what happened was these guys stormed the kitchen, changed the menu and gave everybody a McDonald's and said, why don't you share my downside?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Because here's the thing. At the end of the day, for these guys, they don't believe the mainstream parties will give them an upside. So you might as well go with someone, even if you think they're a bullshit artist a la Trump, because of the bullshit artist, there is at least the possibility of an upside. With someone you've called a liar who you want to lock them up, there is zero possibility. Now, let's go back to the whole thing about, oh, it's all racism, etc. You know what else this allows? It allows the center-left to basically take on board no criticism, no self-examination. There is no need to rethink the policies that they've been involved with. There's no need to rethink the funding model of Wall Street, the identity politics plus Wall Street equals success formula. And what we see with Ellison's defeat, Perez showing up late, the establishment running the DNC again, is exactly this lack of self-examination. And part of what allows you to do this is the self-exculpatory narrative that says, there's nothing wrong with us, it was only turnout, and basically all that made the difference is a bunch of racists. And that is so weak and so damaging. You can write the next defeat of the Democrats right here.
Then, of course, don't forget Vladimir Putin.
How could we forget Vladimir Putin? This incredible octopus-like monster who has been doing things like manipulating emails. Well, it turns out that there are, if your listeners want to go to the piece that was in The Guardian yesterday, which was, wait till I look up the date, which would have been Sunday, the 26th of February, about the guy who owns Renaissance Technologies, an artificial intelligence augmented hedge fund, most successful in the world, owns a firm called Cambridge Analytica that basically looks at people's Facebook profiles, draws all the stuff from that, and then sends news items to them based upon their likes, which simply bomb them to change their preferences. So anything Russia has done is a footnote in comparison to what people who have been working for Trump and working for Brexit are doing all the time.
The funny thing is how the liberals during Democrats during the campaign season last year were full of mockery of the Trump campaign. It was a dumpster fire. The party was in meltdown. And yet, you know, behind the scenes, they were doing this Cambridge Analytica stuff, which was quite sophisticated and probably turned the election.
Absolutely, more than quite sophisticated. I mean, essentially, it's one thing to give people information so they can make choices about who they want to elect or not elect. But it's quite another one to systematically bomb people with nothing more than propaganda. Now, you can say, well, the Democrats do that. That's part of winning elections, etc. But when you're actually using advanced psychometric and psycholinguistic techniques of the type that are used in counterintelligence warfare on your own domestic populations, I think questions need to be asked.
Yes, questions do need to be asked. So let's talk some about what you call the institutional equilibria, you know, the social structures of accumulation in the old Marxist literature. Mm-hmm. Contrasting the 1970s and the last couple of decades, you know, the debtor's paradise versus the creditor's paradise. So could you lay out those paradigms?
So, you know, if I did a talk that was podcasted by Jacobin a couple of weeks ago. So if people want more of this, you can hear it there. But here's the short version, okay? So you go back to 1943. There's a guy who's a refugee economist sitting in a basement, I think it was at the LSE, and his name is Mikhail Kolecki. And at the time, he's reading Keynes's general theory, and he spots a flaw in the software, to use a contemporary term. And this flaw is the following. If you run a regime of full employment for 20 or 30 years, it's going to have some really good effects. It's going to go to a shelter. There's going to be a leftward shift in the income distribution. You're going to get more aggregate growth in consumption. Wage earners are going to benefit. It's exactly what you want the post-war welfare state to do. But here's the problem. It's going to suck for capital eventually, because what's going to happen is the wages are going to be continually bid up. And in the context of super tight labor markets, it means skilled workers at the top of the distribution in particular basically can get free rents. So they can basically get more than a productivity. The only way that capitalists can deal with this is by pushing up prices, because they exist within an institutional regime of accumulation, a set of laws and institutions designed after World War II that said you can't just move your capital abroad. You can't globalize your supply chains. And the technology to do this stuff wasn't there at that period anyway. So what they had to do was improve through productivity in order to basically maintain the profit share. That arrangement started to come apart in the 1970s. And at that point in time, as Kolecki predicted, there would be more than a few economists coming out of the woodwork to declare the situation manifestly unsound. And that's exactly what happened. What happens next is, rather than having a regime that targets full employment, which creates a pathology called inflation, which undermines price stability, leads to greater labor conflict, and leads to a capital strike, what you end up with is a new regime based on opposite principles, that being price stability. So welcome to the rise of independent central banks. And if you want to discipline labor to get the inflation out of the system, you beat them up with anti-union legislation. But crucially, you harness new technologies to globalize supply chains. And after that happens, you live in a world that we've never worked before, which we've seen in this chart many times, where productivity continues to rise, but wages for 60% of the population is at least essentially stagnant. Now, what's driving this? What's driving this is the fact that in every other historical period, labor was able to basically keep capital local and strike and otherwise act against capital in such a way that capital had to innovate its way to maintain its profit share. Now it doesn't. Now it just says, screw you, we're leaving. And if you don't like it, we'll cut your wages. So what we've had is a situation whereby labor's ability to resist has absolutely collapsed. Consequently, capital's ability to accumulate has gone through the roof. It's not just the 1%. It's actually even more concentrated than that, as we know. And we live in a world in which you've got excess savings because capital has been globalized, banks have been deregulated, interest rates are at an all-time low. This has encouraged various asset bubbles and distortions, which were bailed in 2008. And we've limped along for another almost decade with zero rates, zero inflation. 90, the CAT study that came out 2 months ago, 94% of the jobs in the US created since 2008 are agency, contract, part-time, and most carry no benefits. So that's the end of that regime. Now, what's happened is we've had these two regimes, full employment went bust, price stability went bust, and we've put a bunch of band-aids called quantitative easing and various other policies on it, hoping that we'll limp back to the old regime. But that regime is ultimately bust. And what you see with populism, not just with Trump and not just with Le Pen, but also on the left with Syriza, with Podemos, with the Scottish National Party, and a whole bunch of people who are eating away at both the left and right mainstream parties, saying, basta, enough. This has got to change, because all your policies have done is enrich a tiny global super elite and screw most of us.
I'm speaking with Mark Blyth, Professor of Political Economy at Brown. Well, yeah, that's one of the things that struck me about the 2008 crisis, that the system that prevailed from, you know, roughly the late 70s to that crisis did have internal coherence. It squeezed wages, squeezed social benefits, and then the prospect of borrowing money to compensate for the income squeeze was, there was plenty of money to borrow and plenty of
exactly,
borrowing
exactly.
done. That all fell apart in 2008, and here we are almost 10 years later, and nothing has replaced that broken model. We just seem to be stumbling around blindly.
Well, we're stumbling around blindly, but I mean, then think about people like Bannon around Trump, right? So Bannon's political teeth, apparently, according to the various biographies you see, is cut in part on the fact that his father lost a hell of a lot of money in the financial crisis. And he is one of those Tea Party type Republicans who used to be a Democrat, completely lost faith in the establishment because of their treatment and sucking up to Wall Street, of which he was part. Saw this injury in his own family and decided, you know, enough, we're not going to do this again. Now, what you have with these guys is this very nasty white ethno-nationalist, and this is where the racism stuff, I think, is absolutely true, reaction. Now, why do I say it's white ethno-nationalist? Because when Bannon talks about the nation, I don't think he has a kind of like multicultural pluricity of different cultures in mind. He said at the CPAC convention, he was talking about nationalism as defined by a culture. Well, I think we have a pretty clear, a clear idea as to what culture that is. So to quote George Bernard Shaw on this one, or at least I think it was Shaw, nationalism isn't just the last refuge of a scoundrel. It's drawing room fascism. It's the polite racism of the chattering middle classes. And that's the alternative that is emerging everywhere, is a nationalist reaction.
There's pictures of Trump, and he always looks angry. And I look at a lot of people who voted for them. They're just intensely angry. And I'm really at a loss sometimes to figure out what some of these people are so angry about.
Well, it's really interesting because, you know, the majority of the Trump vote came from older people. Older people outvote younger people 2-1. Numerically, there are now more millennials than baby boomers because society evolves one funeral at a time. But nonetheless, they don't vote in equivalent numbers. So guess which way the policies skew. Now, as to regards to why they're angry, well, yeah, I mean, I can understand it in the sense that if you live in one of those blue states where the roads have got potholes, state tuition for university is now $30,000, you've elected government after government locally, does nothing but tax cuts, which benefit very few people, and your job gets every time you renegotiate a new contract, you lose something. And the people that are meant to be helping you don't give a damn and are stuck in I mean, how many people graduate from elite universities and say, what are you doing next year? Oh, I'm moving to Cleveland, right? That just doesn't happen. So if this is the case and this is the world you're in, I do actually get why they're pissed.
I'm not talking about that sorts of people, but, you know, there's an affluent portion of the Trump base that's also extremely angry.
Right. Well, so let me get to that point. Here's my favorite example of this. Right? Do you recall just at the end of last year, there was a thing that Congress did a kumbaya on and came together and said, let's finally pass a bipartisan law. It was called the Cancer Moonshot. Do you remember this?
No, I don't.
All right. So they found $6.2 billion, which isn't that great for doing a moonshot, but nonetheless, it's good for publicity. It was Joe Biden who was behind it on his way out the door, given his son died terribly because of blastoma, et cetera, et cetera. So they did this thing. Okay. Now, as you know, Congress has offsets so that if you are going to spend more money in one area, if you're not going to raise revenue for it, you have to take the cuts in another area. So guess where they found most of the money for the cancer moonshot? It was preventative care. Now, who gets cancer? Old people. Who get benefits from preventative care? Young people. So the point I want to make is there's a generational story here whereby the people that really should be feeling the anger are the ones who aren't showing up to vote. And the ones who seem to be angry about everything are the ones who have their Social Security lockboxed. They're the ones that will never see cuts of their Medicare. They're the ones that get everything thrown at them by both of these parties. Little stat on this one. I looked this up just 2 weeks ago. If you look at elderly poverty rates in the United States on a statewide basis, and like one Google search will get you to the relevant data, right? It varies from 5% to 9%. That's pretty low. You know what the poverty rate varies amongst millennials? 20 to 25%.
The way to solve that problem is not by attacking Social Security and Medicare, but by making the provision of benefits to younger people more generous.
Or alternatively, lifting the cap on Social Security and truly making it a universalized program. I'm not advocating for that. I'm simply going along with your point that there are certain people who are affluent, who have everything going their way, and they seem to be totally pissed off all the time. Well, you know, there's lots of reasons behind this. We can go all the way back to the Bush administration and the colored lights for fear. We could go back to endless books and programs showing that terrorism's on the rise in the United States, when in fact you're more likely to be shot by a toddler than you are a terrorist. But, you know, as we know, we don't live in a fact-based world anymore.
A lot of the anger from these angry people of up and down the class spectrum is directed towards immigrants. What's your evaluation of the role of, and I see George Borjas has an anti-immigrant piece in the New York Times op-ed page today.
Oh, really? That's a first.
Yeah, it's breaking fresh ground. He does come clean in the first paragraph that he is an immigrant himself, but now that he's in.
But that's almost like me doing Scottish jokes and saying, it's not racism, I'm allowed to say that, I'm Scottish, which is kind of true, but you know, yeah, exactly.
What's your evaluation of the role of immigration in the economic distress, you know, of heartland working class people?
From a certain point of view, if you look, for example, at David Autor's website, China Shock, which estimates sort of lost income, or rather how much more it would have cost to make something in the heartland versus China, and therefore what the income loss is, you can see that there's a reason for people to be upset by things like NAFTA and the WTO and China's accession. When you globalize labor markets, guess who loses? It's the people who are in the expensive labor markets. So there's certainly that's part of the story, but it is only part of the story. So how then do you demonize immigrants? Well, you keep this narrative going for years, and I've been here for 26 years, and this has been going as long as I have, about illegal immigrants. And, okay, fine, you know, all those illegal immigrants who basically clean all the upper middle class homes, the ones that pick all the tomatoes, the ones that build most of the houses, right? So they're the people that you're going to decide to throw out now. Well, you know, good luck with that one when you find out they're integral parts of your economy. Europe has a similar sort of thing, but it's with migrants rather than immigrants. And again, it's the fear of the other, the generalized fear of Islam, which has also come to bear on this. Now, you can't do that with people from Mexico and Guatemala, etc. So for them, it's a kind of economic threat, and they're illegal and they need to go back. Well, as Llewellyn King said the other day, homosexuality used to be illegal. It's not now. Drink alcohol at one point was illegal. It's not now. So the fact that somebody currently counts as an illegal immigrant is a pretty weak read when they're actually integrated into your society. And you see the same thing in Europe. So, you know, what's my take home on this? The National Front in France is a great example of this. They have a very simple narrative that explains to people who haven't seen their wages grow in two decades what's going on. Globalization took their jobs and Islamism took their neighborhoods. Fight back. What exactly is the centre-left's argument? We need to maintain fealty to the European budgetary rules and cut our budgets. Good luck.
Yeah, we've been talking mostly about the United States, but much of what we've been talking about could, with appropriate revisions, be applied to the EU today, Greg.
It is. I mean, this is, this is the phrase I didn't actually invent it. Somebody else came up with it first, but I came with it independently, which is global Trumpism. Right, this is going on everywhere. There's a guy who looks like the sort of Willy Wonka's evil twin who might win the Netherlands. It's entirely possible under certain scenarios that the left simply doesn't show up to vote against Le Pen and she could actually win. In which case, the future of the euro, if not the EU itself, is really in question. So yeah, Trump is what we focus on because we're here, because it's America, because it's important, because they do seem to be genuinely crazy. They're going to shut down the EPA. They're going to defund the State Department. Who in their right minds runs a global hegemon where everybody else has to borrow dollars to make things work and we get to print it? And what we want to do is defund the State Department. I mean, really, that's up there. I don't know how to process that other than you just hate the state. But nonetheless, get away from America and you see very, very similar patterns happening everywhere.
This was the first part of my interview with Mark Blythe, professor of political economy at Brown. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the first movement to Brahms' Sextet for Strings, Opus 18, performed by the Amadeus Quartet. And now on to part two of my interview with Mark Blythe, professor of political economy at Brown. It's hard to see how the EU is responsible for any of the ills affecting Britain today, but the EU became the target. Britain imposed Margaret Thatcher and David Cameron on itself. It didn't come from Brussels. But how do you explain the Brexit vote?
I'd explain the Brexit vote the same way that I would jump back to America for a minute to make a point about this. If you really want to look at what's hurt people in the heartland and elsewhere, is it globalization? It's part of it. But it's also automation. Even China is losing manufacturing jobs. So the whole notion that everybody's somehow going to bring all these jobs back, I think, is a little bit suspect at best, right? Now, go to Britain and go to Brexit. Go to Sunderland in the north. They've got a big car plant for Nissan that exports most of its stuff to the EU. And they were 61% to get out. Now, either you tell a story that people are stupid and don't understand their interests, etc., which, you know, may be the case in some cases, maybe in some of the cases true. But a simpler explanation is their version of American politics is London. And London is a bubble with insane property prices where everything went bust, but everything got bailed. And then there was austerity for the rest of the country. And they're the ones who are carrying the can, who are expected to pay more for everything from healthcare to university if they're lucky enough to get their kids there in the first place, etc., etc. Every time these guys negotiate a new contract with Nissan, a little bit more is taken away. It's a common story. So any chance that they have to basically vent their frustration, they're going to take it. There's the same with Renzi in Italy with the, let's have a constitutional referendum about constitutional reform. No, let's just tell you, you suck. And that's exactly what happened. And strangely, both the elites in the EU and also in the US on the Democratic side just seem to think this is noise. This is like children acting out. It's not. It's an incredibly important signal here that they simply don't believe much of what they're told anymore. And if you don't change your story to one they can believe in, then they're going to go with the right.
What do you see as the effects of Brexit? We've seen a lot of dire economic predictions that have not yet come to pass. What's going to happen if Britain leaves, as it looks like it's going to?
All right, so here's something where I really don't know how to think about this. I'm not going to give you a definitive answer. I'm going to tell you a story first, right? So here's the story. Let's think about everything economists got wrong over the past, let's say, 20 years, right? So free integrated financial markets are welfare improving. The globalization of labor markets and product markets leads to gains for everybody. We live in a great moderation in volatility wrought by good central bank policy. Banks are the best judge of their own risk, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So should we really be surprised when the entire economic establishment stands up and says, Brexit's going to be bad for you, and it turns out that it's not? Now, is that a vindication of the Brexiteer stance? Well, here's the thing, time will tell, because here's a story as to what's going on. Because of the globalization of everything, because of the integration of Britain into the European economy, Britain still has, and this is what saved it, the pound. And the pound took a hell of a beating after Brexit, so much so I was there in January and finally bought a jacket I'd been eyeing for 15 years. It was so cheap. And I'm Scottish, you know how cheap that has to get. So they take a huge hit on the devaluation side. Because of that, half of Europe comes to London to shop. So what you see is a boost in retail. What you see is a boost in the consumption and services side of the economy. None of the financial firms have done anything more than exploratory moves abroad. They did a trial balloon on this back in 2008 when the Gordon Brown's administration put up the marginal tax rate to 50 pence in the pound. There was a whole bunch of hedge funds in particular that said, sod this, we're off to Switzerland. Well, the Swiss don't want you. They're having cantonal revolts about these people moving in and pushing up property prices. But more importantly, one of the biggest firms that was out there in London moved out and came back. You know why they came back? They were bored. It turns out being in London's fun. Being stuck halfway up a mountain in Switzerland, even with lower taxes, isn't. So point of the story here. It's too early to tell, but if all that's happening is a devaluation bounce and a consumption boost, at the end of the day, you're going to be buying your imports with cheaper pounds. And unless you're going to get a massive increase in productivity, that means stuff will cost more. So the British people are more likely than not about to experience the next 2 years a step function increase in the cost of living, which also means higher inflation through import channel. And that also means that their standard of living will go down again, and they will want higher wages, which are not growing. Quite how Theresa May is going to address that when we get to it, I don't know. My favorite line on Brexit was a tweet that came out afterwards. And it said, Merkel, what do you want? May, Brexit means Brexit. Merkel, you've no idea, do you? May, no.
Now, I once spoke with a Thatcher advisor, his name escapes me, but at a conference, and he said to me that Thatcher's most lasting achievement was the transformation of the Labour Party. And we've seen, you know, that kind of transformation affected the centre-left parties on the continent and in the United States, the Democratic Party. These parties have really just become the slightly left wing of capital.
Yeah, basically. I mean, I'll give you a little personal story on this one. So when was it? September last year, I think it was. I went to the Economics and Finance Ministry. No, sorry, Economics. What's it called? The Economics and Energy Ministry, not the Finance Ministry. They would never let me in the door. I went to the Economics and Energy Ministry. There was a conference on and I was asked to go. And this is where the head of the SPD, right, Zygmunt Gabriel, has his shop, right? That's his ministry as part of the coalition. So I show up and I say to my German colleagues, so where's Zygmunt today? Is he at the conference? And I said, no, he's in Belgium. I said, what's he in Belgium? He's beating up the Walloons to make sure that they sign on to TTP. Now, there's the head of the German Social Democrats who is out there beating up on a bunch of lefties in Belgium who think that investor protection clauses in a ginormous trade agreement that threatens the very essence of democratic choice might be a bad thing. And he's the bully boy for capital.
And of course, these are the same parties that did nothing to side with Greece when it's being squeezed by Frankfurt and Brussels.
No, worse than that, the German SPD was first out of the gate. They were the very first people to get out there in the front line and basically poop all over them. Now, why were they doing this? Think about it this way. If you go to 1997, and there's a little graph in The Economist, I saw this. If you go to 1997 and make that index 100 and you look at left vote share in Europe, there's a little spike around 2000, and then it's just been dropping off a cliff. You used to be able to elect the Swedish Social Democrats with a dead Labrador with a red rosette with an election of 50,000 majority. Now they're in coalition with the not democratic Swedish Democrats. The SPD are currently neck and neck in the polls with the CDU because they've changed their leader to the much more actually appealing Martin Schulz. Away from Zygmunt Gabriel. But their vote was trending around 20 to 25%. You don't form a government with this. So all of these parties have basically collapsed down to a core of voters who will never vote for anybody else, who, if you're in Corbyn's world, basically are, you know, part of that ideological constituency. And if you had PR in Britain, they would actually have representation, but they don't. So they're basically going to be permanently in exile. And then if you look at it across in Germany, you've got yet another grand coalition coming up to keep out the AfD. You've got another kind of everybody shows up to block the National Front in France. What exactly are these people arguing for? As a friend of mine called Robin, who put it beautifully, he said, you know, what's going on just now is that 20 years ago, a generation of politicians took over who thought that all problems are technical problems. So we have these technocrats and technocratic solutions. We give up our trade policy to the WTO. We give it up to this independent central banks, and parliaments become basically talking shops that tweet about nonsense. And then suddenly there's a crisis and they have to equip themselves, but they can't. And then down the line, they forgot the most important thing. You need to offer a positive vision of where we're going in order for people to sign on and believe in you. And we haven't done that for 25 years. Now, when you give up that vision, if there's no positive future, all you have is a glorious past. Who always owns the rights to the glorious past? The right.
Well, you know, go back, I don't know, 20, 25, 30 years, and these center-left parties were concerned that their platforms were too left for the public, and they needed to move to the center to be more electable. That was certainly the appeal of, you know, Bill Clinton and Tony Blair. It hasn't really worked out for them. How do you explain what happened to them? Is it just the growing power of money, ideological confusion, getting the times wrong? How do you explain it?
Well, how about all of the above? But just, the growing power of money is certainly there. But let's focus on another one. There's a journal called Comparative Political Studies, and I think it's 2013 or 2012. There's a paper by three authors, primary authors from the University of Colorado. The names escape me. And it's called Catch All or Catch and Release. And what it does is look at the SPD and New Labour and said, what did these guys do? They moved to the middle, they started to win elections, and then they just catastrophically lost. And what they figured out is that when you move to the middle, you have to abandon the tail. Because the only way you're going to capture the middle is if you kind of basically not just give up, you distance yourself from the core at the bottom that used to show up for you, your industrial workers, people on welfare, people that you meant to have these considerations for. Because they don't have any money and they don't vote. And they will vote for you, but they don't have any money and they don't vote in enough numbers. So when you move to the middle, what happens is if you've got the right PR campaign, you hit the right moment, you've got Tony Blair, you've got Gerhard Schroeder, yeah, you can energize, you can capture these guys, but you don't own them and they owe you nothing. So the minute you start to disappoint them or they get bored with you, they're gone. They swim away. It's catch and release. And then you turn back to your tail and you've lost all credibility with your tail. So when you turn back and you turn up in these states, as we saw in the last election here, and you say, hey, why is everybody complaining? We've got full employment back. We're defending Obama's legacy. For many people, it just rings very, very hollow.
In the case of Hillary Clinton, she really didn't even try. She didn't visit Wisconsin. She didn't visit a single UAW union hall in Michigan, even though Obama, you know, could be said to have saved the auto industry. And they didn't brag about it. It was almost like they were embarrassed at having saved the auto industry.
Well, think about who you talk to. And you see this with Brexit as well. And people talk about the London bubble, right? So let's think about the hacked emails. My favorite one from that was the hack of Podesta. I think it was Tom Frank that did this in a piece in The Guardian. Apparently, if you look through this for place names, the most common place name is Martha for Martha's yes. Vineyard, right?
Yes.
The next one is the Hamptons. The next one is New York, then San Francisco, with everything else trailing a massive, massive distant second. So who are you talking to? You're talking to a bunch of slightly left-leaning elites who understand that democracy is asset insurance for the rich and worry that we've been skimping on the payments whilst drinking mint juleps in the Hamptons.
I'm speaking with Mark Blyth, Professor of Political Economy at Brown. A lot of people on the left have been rooting for financial crises forever. This was supposed to be like the deus ex machina that was going to cause the population to lose its illusions about capitalism and embrace some sort of left-wing agenda. The financial crisis didn't really produce that result. The political gainer from it seems to have been the right, rather far right in many cases. What about the politics of financial crises? Are people right in thinking that they lead to some kind of forced enlightenment?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, what we see most clearly with the Greek case and the whole issue of the Greek bailouts, that was Greece was used as a conduit where money was lent bilaterally by governments to these governments who gave them straight back to banks to basically make their balance sheets whole. There was no punishment for errant lending. There was only ever a nasty story about you've borrowed too much. Completely forgetting, of course, that you can't borrow too much unless somebody's willing to lend you too much. But let's not go there. So again, the Eurozone crisis is absolutely emblematic in this. The Eurozone as a whole, even with Germany's economic growth, which is premised upon everybody else not having a German model of growth, has produced a lost decade for its citizens. Right, literally, they're just getting back up to where they were before the crisis now. It's been a horrible, slow, semi-recovery, and for some countries, it hasn't been a recovery at all. But who hasn't lost? Capital hasn't lost. They invented the European Stability Fund. The European Stability Fund transfers itself into a private company whose shareholders are governments located in Luxembourg, whose job it was in 2012 to buy the remaining toxic debt from the periphery, from the banks, and put it into this thing called the ESM. Now, progressively, you could then say, great, now we can use that to basically collateralize more debt and have euro bonds and lower the risk for everyone. No, we'll just sit around and demand repayment. So this is just a macro example of something that vexed people, believe it or not, you will recall, vexed some people in the Tea Party back in the day, was the financial crisis was essentially socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor.
Well, how do we get out of this?
I've really become incredibly pessimistic that the only way that you can get out of this is when the boomers slip the mortal coil. Because that is the majority of support, and both parties play the game of knowing that's exactly where the votes are. Boomers own 75% of financial assets. In the United States, we currently spend 17% of GDP on healthcare. We're going to go to 20%, basically, as the boomers try and live forever with spending those assets. We don't invest. We insist that every generation below us pays more and more for less and less because we're not willing to pay taxes on anything. And that's a lock. Now, whether that has a Trump-esque character to it or whether it has a Clinton-esque character to it, of course, there's massive, massive differences. I wouldn't say that, you know, the lesser of two evils things is totally ridiculous at this point. But the one thing that they're agreed on, and we will see it this week in Trump's budget proposal, is that seniors will not take a hit, but the entirety of the rest of the federal budget will. Now, that only changes when two things happen. When millennials start to get organized and start to vote in large numbers, which was why the end of Ellison's campaign was very disheartening. And the second thing is, and this is the more hopeful one, that there may be some technological fixes going on which can help us out of the really big problems, which of course are like climate change, etc. And I think the sort of a combination of basically aging plus new people coming in plus basically some nice tech fixes and the rest of the world getting annoyed with America giving up on climate change. If America turns its back on climate change, then it might actually just be the impetus for the Germans to make the tech and the Chinese to go to scale with it. So there might be something good that comes out of this, but it's a wild card shot. But I think in the short to medium term, we're absolutely stuck with a horrible set of policies.
Now, maybe it's my demographic speaking, but this generational analysis strikes me as misleading in that a long trajectory of decline is going to be experienced as a successive generational decline. And if we just look at this as some sort of generational struggle, we're missing the larger picture of deep systemic decline and crisis.
Right. I think that's absolutely true. They're a symptom rather than a cause, but they're also causally important because these are the people who interpret that decline as I've got to hold on to everything that I've already earned in my lifetime and to hell with the next generation. If you look at statistics on climate change denial, it's the old, it's not the young. And the argument that everyone uses is, well, I know that the world sucks, but I'm saving it all up because I want to leave it to my kids, is like the classic argument against libertarians and the fire brigade. You can't buy your own fire brigade if the city's on fire. But that's exactly what this generation has been trying to do. So I think there is actually, it's not so much like there's a generational explanation. I think a missing component here is rather than looking at left or right, economics versus race, there really is an old versus young component right across the world. And you just need to look up a couple of statistics to see this, whether it's to do with which group is in poverty, which group has financial assets, which one doesn't. And your average Australian now is living at home as long as your average Italian, and they have an Anglo property market. Why? Because of this weird thing called negative gearing, which basically allows you to own multiple properties and run down the costs against the depreciation of the house. So all the housing for rent is owned by one generation in Australian cities, which means you get a constriction of supply, a massive increase in value, and nobody under 40 can buy a damn house. That's an intergenerational trade-off. All right? I'll give you another example of this. The British government privatized de facto, they've never really said it, but they privatized higher education. So everybody pays $9,000 to $12,000 a year and so on and so forth. That's it. Now, this is a massive balance sheet liability that has been taken away from the British government. And I said to someone who knows both, who's on the board of one of the old famous universities and knows the British government, the Tory side, very well, you guys have saved all this money. Where did it go? You didn't do around the tax cuts. What happened? And he looked at me with all sincerity and said, it's the NHS. It's a monster. It eats everything. Well, yeah, when you have an aging population and you're not willing to raise taxes, your healthcare system's going to eat everything. That's an intergenerational put. You're basically saying you don't get free education because we have to pay for grandma's third knee operation because nobody's willing to raise taxes.
Of course, one of the oldest people ever to run for president was pushing free college.
Yeah, no, exactly, which was going to cost, what was the cost estimate on that? It was incredibly low. I think it was $12 billion. $12 billion. I mean, here's one. Okay, here's what you do. You want, you know, a more positive, simpler story, right? Here's a simple one. My co-author, Sven Steinmo, has calculated this. If you look at tax expenditures, right, things that we give away for free, if you look at the top 15 tax expenditures, they come to over $1 trillion a year. So just get rid of two of those tax expenditures and you can fund free college. But what you'd have to do then is take away the mortgage interest deduction from people like me. What you'd have to do is take away the, you can only pay 15% taxes or less if you shell company it, if you're a hedge fund manager. And those people are likely to say in the abstract, oh yes, college is hideously expensive, we should do something about it. But they are personally not going to do something about it. And no politician's going to go up and try and take it away from them.
Now, of course, the neoliberals have always loved the targeted benefit. If you have free college, then rich people are going to get some advantage from that, as well as poor people. What about that targeted versus universal question?
It's moronic. I mean, it's a bit like saying, okay, so imagine there's a windfall lottery and everybody in the country gets $1,000. Well, you know, rich people will benefit too. Right, but they're already rich. $1,000 is a rounding error. To somebody who has $1,000, doubling their income is absolutely massive. It's simple proportion. It's always been the case with tax cuts, etc. Only they work in reverse. So we're going to get a round of tax cuts skewed towards the middle with the Trump administration, according to the new Treasury Secretary. Right, let's find out if that one's going to work, because any analysis I've seen so far is this is just massive give back to the top 1% again.
The EU... can it save itself from itself? Can it escape the austerity model that is at the core of the thing and the creation of the euro? Or will it just have to come apart?
It's incredible. I mean, I despair. I mean, how much disconfirming evidence do you need that a policy isn't working? I mean, come on. And you've got a whole generation now that basically... so if you imagine that sort of like your skills of an average person are gained when you leave high school, through college, and then for the next 10 years, that's when you pretty much begin to hit your 10 years of peak income. You've now got a bunch of people in Europe, literally millions of them, who hit the crisis around the age of 23, 24, and have never worked. Their skill formation has gone to zero. Their ability to add to productivity, etc., is gone. And what are employers in Europe doing? They're doing the same as here. Half of the total population's new jobs since the crisis have been agency, contract, part-time, limited benefits, etc. So everyone's economic insecurity has gone up. And now at the same time, you have a bunch of people sitting in Brussels and Berlin constantly harping on about fiscal rules and probity and how Europe needs to have, basically they need to go tighten the budgets in Italy and Spain again because they're running two big deficits. And I keep pointing out to them, nobody ever died of a deficit. But it doesn't really matter because you'll allow people to die through insecurity and poverty because you have to guard the reputation and probity of these fiscal institutions. This is a mission that has no cause. It's on autopilot. And if you think that people have, you know, problems believing the mainstream left in the United States, they're absolutely fed up with the European story. So I worry greatly about this. And Le Pen, she may not get in. My money at the beginning of the year was that she would, because I think there's a real issue with turnout on the left, because what you're essentially asking everybody in the center left, the right and the left who don't agree with each other at all, but all hate the National Front, and maybe a lot of them don't, let's be honest, right, to turn out in a big lineup and say no. And then you're going to do the same thing in Germany with the AfD. Now, what you're saying to people is, we don't really have a vision for you. We don't have anything for you to vote for. It's just another round of budgetary austerity. But they're racists. You have to go out and stop them. They're the only people that are proposing some kind of change. How long can democracy be reduced to a blocking coalition before people find that illegitimate?
That was Mark Blyth, professor of political economy at Brown and author, among other things, of Austerity, the History of a Dangerous Idea. As much as I like Mark Blyth, I really don't like this generational warfare line that he indulged in at a couple of points during the interview. It does no one except the austerity party any good to foment hostility between young and old. In the current political environment, the inevitable results of complaints about the expense of Social Security and Medicare and the alleged excess of resources spent on the old won't result in new benefits for the young, but only cuts to the programs for the elderly. The austerity party's design, and by the austerity party I mean Republicans and corporate Democrats, is to reduce opposition to such cuts by shielding present beneficiaries, or those about to enjoy the benefits, while denying them to those 10 or 30 years away from them. I understand that that's not where Mark Blythe is coming from, but I'm afraid his rhetoric won't do us any favors. Also, most older people don't have a lot of assets. Of households aged 55 and over, fewer than 5% own stocks, fewer than 20% own bonds, and only about half have some sort of retirement account. What assets they have are mostly in their houses. The median value of retirement plans held by households aged 50 to 55 was $8,000 a few years ago. For those 56 to 61, the median holding was $17,000. There's no denying that younger people are worse off than older people, and while this has always been true, the gaps are wider now than they used to be. But older people aren't rolling in it, and it's politically pernicious to suggest that they are. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this tangentially appropriate bit of Poverty, Vanity, and Revenge, a song from about 10 years ago by the London-based electronic duo Punk's Soundcheck from the compilation Berlin Insane 3. Till next week, bye.
Don't want to be your slave tonight. I've been in the gutter, and I'm not going back. No, not ever. I've been the butt of too many jokes for the amusement of regular blows. Give me words and a beat and I'm